Mormon Stories Podcast takes a ton of work and depends solely upon listener support. To keep this program alive, please consider a donation today at mormonstories.org.
So let's just assume that we're not going to be able to, just by the fact that she has so many words in her book invoking Logos, I think we can all agree we're never going to escape it, that we need to find a way to mix these two things. Is it fair to put limits on where Logos need not tread within religion and spirituality? Can we do that? Can we say that here's where you go too far when you start trying to bring the intellect into the religious experience? Or here are areas where the intellect is not welcome. Let's start with Joanna.
Oh, see, I'm like Jay. I like the room and the music too. I mean, in my comments, I didn't mean to give the sense that, you know, that I don't see intellectual practice as a form of spiritual discipline, because it is. It's not something that's really valued within contemporary Mormonism to a great degree, but it sure is. You know, the theologians I learned to really love and admire, have spent time with in my own scholarship, you know, are people like Jonathan Edwards, who, you know, who after mastering, you know, incredible amounts of intellectual content, were finally pushing themselves to use the medium of language to not betray what they had experienced. And so he comes down to sweetness, right? He's a thinking man. He's an intellectual, he's a theologian, and he directs us to the taste, right? To sweetness. So there's a way in which I think intellectual practice done with humility and with dedication leads to greater experiential depth, not greater than other people's, but for the person who feels called to do the intellectual work. Does that make sense? I'm not prioritizing or preferring one path to another. I'm just saying, for those of us who wake up with these inclinations or these callings or these, you know, burdens of being intellectual types, like, why not? I want to reserve some space for the intellect within all this. Yes, please.
What about just the simple exercise of trying to demonstrate scriptural historicity? Is there ever a place for that or a value?
Well, here's my bigger intellectual question, and forgive me for just hopping in, is, you know, what is the state of Mormon intellectual life right now? Where do we find ourselves in this book? How do we position ourselves in relationship to these great world historical conversations? You know, if we, you know, Mormons reading this, we are not in the index. We are not even in the narrative. You know, where do we place ourselves? Now, historically, we'd put ourselves like, you know, we can find a page that's about the moment that Joseph Smith came. It's like page 236. I marked it. Right.
There's something about the Second Great Awakening, and they're talking about
the Second Great Awakening.
And they that's us.
And the word she doesn't use that many of these disciples of Christ movements at the time were using to refer to themselves were restorationists, right? And our doctrine of the restoration has caused us oftentimes to place ourselves in an exceptional position to world religious history. We have an entirely different, how do we square the narrative of, you know, the great apostasy and the restoration against this account? Can we make common ground with this account at all as Mormon readers? You know, are Mormon intellectuals doing the kind of work that allows us to engage in this global conversation about faith? We've had some conversations with evangelicals, but we're not, I don't know that we're there yet.
I'm going to say there's one thing, one way in which I think we can really engage well with this intellectual project, a kind of amazing irony, which is, you know, we've noted that Armstrong wants to take her preferred mode of spirituality and kind of project it back all the way to, I guess, almost, you know,
India.
Hunter-gatherers. The caves, exactly.
The caves.
Amazingly, she knows what they thought, and it's what she thinks. And exactly. The thing that I love about that is that that is exactly the Mormon impulse.
Ah. You know,
we want to take our spirituality and make it ancient, because ancient is best. And that at least is a narrative move that I see myself in.
Yeah,
Adam got baptized, and Jesus was married in the temple and did an endowment ceremony,
yes.
Right?
And,
yes.
And either Mary or Martha was Relief Society president.
Right.
Yeah, Peter didn't do his home teaching, so.
Well, who's going to answer? John Hammer, are you going to answer Joanna's question about how we can step up and be part of the global conversation? Or are we forever destined to be the stepchild redheaded misfits of
exceptional?
Of what?
Exceptional. Sometimes we talk about American exceptionalism. I mean, if we're the American religion, we have our own form of Mormon exceptionalism. Where do we belong in this world story?
But I guess I don't think that Mormons are engaging in this kind of conversation with religions that much, or even we've talked about it before as defining out some of these just basic theologies. When you go through and when you read all of these histories of theology and you read the medieval Christian theologies and all of the different ideas that everybody from Anselm, Canterbury, and Thomas Aquinas and everyone is formulating everything about all of the nature of God, why this works this way, why that works that way. There's been all kinds of wonderful speculation where in this conversation tonight where Jay or Joanna has explained, well, if we think of our Mormon concept this way and kind of expand it out and talk about this, the laws of the universe as being like our God. But the point is, we haven't actually, it hasn't actually been formulated. In other words, there isn't a defined or even really long, it's not even if we all agreed to one theology, even somebody simply spelling one out like that and how it all fits together and how it all works. It's mostly just a couple, I mean, there's beliefs, but they're not all put together like that.
No, I think that's right. And, you know, I mean, this is something that causes all, we're too busy talking to ourselves. We can't talk to anyone else and we can't hear what they have to say. And this has funny consequences. One of my favorites is the concept of God that we think other Christians have and that we rebut. Actually, it's heretical according to the creeds. The concept of the gods, of the Trinity as being one person, that's right. Modalism. That's not Trinitarianism. The Trinity is three persons with one substance. Now, what exactly that means, that's very hard. But we don't even get close to that. We just talk about how, you know, for them, Jesus and Heavenly Father are the same. Well, no, that's just not true. That's a conversation with ourselves, not anyone else.
I remember the first time I was telling somebody who I didn't believe in the Trinity, you know, and I remember telling some Protestant that they believed that, and they're like, well, I didn't believe that, you know. And so, right. And I was like, wait a second, now what is the Trinity, you know? So,
or even coming, you know, landing in graduate school and ending up with other, you know, people of faith, people, you know, raised in conservative Orthodox traditions who were, you know, studying postmodernism at the great university, and not having the native language coming out of BYU to be able to have a discussion with them about 19th or 20th century theologians who are pretty common to the whole Protestant family. Like, everyone's a part of this family tree, and I had no purchase. You know, like, we have a long way to go in developing, as a culture, a greater facility with the conversations, the global conversations about faith.
It seems like if I had to give a novice stab at why this conversation isn't happening and why we're not included, I can think of three or four dynamics. The first is that we doctrinally, theologically have such a level of certainty that we don't think anybody else has anything to add to our conclusions. And so we don't seek them out because we feel like we don't need their insight. That's number one. Secondly, We subjugate their primary text in terms of Christianity, the Bible, to the Book of Mormon. And so, you know, we don't see their fundamental scriptural texts as being equivalent, to ours. But then if you flip it around, I think that probably almost everybody outside of Mormonism does not view the Book of Mormon as a credible religious text because of its lack of archaeological, geographical, etc.ical, problems. And so, they sort of view us as a laughingstock because we're not legitimate, you know?
Which is totally illegitimate by, even by the lived religion methodologies of religious studies. I mean, there's a lot of work the academy needs to do too, or, you know, and other intellectuals need to do too in developing greater respect for the tradition that is Mormonism. It is a robust, complicated tradition. And you know, we just aren't invited to those reindeer games quite yet, but that's not to say it won't happen. And I think as our tradition grows more self-aware, it'll happen.
Wouldn't you say that part of the problem, I was just going to say, wasn't part of the problem in terms of developing a theology, the tradition of lay leadership, where there's a major skepticism and about professional church leaders. And so any idea of, like, let's say, professional church leader training is also therefore looked on with suspicion, because if you're going to do all of that sort of, you know, professional training, then you're if anything, you're going to be led away from personal inspiration or being led the way you should be led.
Yep.
And then there's, I think, a point that fits nicely with that is possibly one reason that we aren't at the table with the theologians and philosophers is that Mormon's preferred genre has been just a different one. You know, we don't write abstract ideas. We write personal experiences. We write journals and personal narratives. We tell our conversion experiences and tell our family histories and tell our miracles. And that for us has been, and to some extent continues to be, much more important than nailing down exactly what it means to say that God the Father and God the Son are separate or not separate or whatever it is that we think.
It seems like Armstrong would agree. It seems like Armstrong would agree that maybe those conversations that are going on that Joanna talks about are of little relative value, and those activities that we're busily engaging in that are part of our religious practice are actually where it's at.
We have mythos.
Yeah.
Our narratives. I love what Jay's just said about the narrative quality of our theology. We have a very applied theology. You know, we have, we have mythos. We're still a people of the mythos.
in doing all that history, though, and so I have a lot of, you know, spent a lot of time in the Mormon historians community. It's still also, though, all done internally. So we all talk to each other. And then if anybody comes in and wants to do it from outside and do Mormon history, they are immediately assassinated. Right on the inside. So.
And in ethnic studies and religious studies, you know, I'm almost always the only Mormon in the room. Always. Always.
Oh, well, that's true in political science for me too. So.
Yeah.
Well, it wasn't always that way. There was a time where we were graduating more PhDs, male and female, per capita than any other state in the early 1900s. Isn't that right? You guys heard that before?
Mm-mm.
No, I've never heard it either.
Well, that's what some professors at BYU told me back. You know. So that must be true.
Mythos!
Mythos.
Yeah. I would be a little surprised.
Astonished.
I mean, yeah. I would guess that Massachusetts would beat us every year.
Per capita?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
MDs, maybe. I mean, there's the vaunted, you know, legacy of the female doc, you know, but PhDs.
Yeah, I know.
Well, let me extend that this line of thought a little bit to sort of a question I came up with. I mean, as I think about what was most formative in my early Orthodox, almost fundamentalist views of Mormonism, it was people like Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie. And if I think back to what they're trying to do in books like Doctrines of Salvation and Mormon Doctrine, it's like, in a sense, or even those seminary film strips that we used to watch in the 70s, like Mormon America, you know, the Ancient America Speaks or whatever, the ones I used to show on my mission, it does seem like we did what Karen Armstrong's talking about. We basically said, we not only think that science has value, we're going to use science to prove our religion. And so, as I understand it, when the papyri were discovered in the 1960s, didn't we actually, as LDS people, try and get Egyptologists to validate that actually the you know, Book of Abraham really was an accurate translation? And didn't we try and use anthropology, you know, regarding ancient America, to try and demonstrate through discoveries of baptismal fonts in Aztec temples that in reality, you know, science proves that Mormonism's true? And even now, don't the apologists try and use archaeological or DNA evidence to bolster their own claims?
Yeah, I think that might be right. It might be. Can you hear my daughter?
That's okay. It's beautiful.
All right. She actually has an ear infection, which isn't so beautiful.
Aww.
anyway, she'll get better. There are antibiotics in the world, which I'm grateful for the logos there. But no, I think it might be right that those things created or were not a moment when we tried to use science to prove our, and that might have consequences, but I'm still proud of that. I think that's a great thing to do, to take your beliefs seriously enough to try and go and see if they're right. I mean, maybe you end up learning that you have to rethink things or you were wrong or something like that. But I love that our ancestors took them seriously enough to try.
I don't think that right from the start that Mormonism ever had an idea of itself that it was antagonistic to science. So I don't think that Joseph Smith and all the other early leaders are simply saying, I think that they rather are thinking that that the religion that they're revealing is consonant with scientific discovery. And as things are going to be discovered, those are only going to prove Mormonism. And so I think that there's been this idea all along, I think, that we can look at all of these science as a way to help prove things. But the problem has arisen when then conflicts do arise, and then people have to try to resolve beliefs with what scientific findings are.
I mean, my sense too is that we are so acutely aware that we're not at the table. That apologetics and that's even itself kind of a defensive word. I love how Jay put it, what our ancestors did trying to bring their best intellectual technologies to bear to defend this tradition they loved, to justify it, to celebrate its power and its beauty. As long as we feel that we have to keep doing that, we're missing out on one of, I think, the greater responsibilities of any, as long as that keeps absorbing most of our intellectual, theological, imaginative energies as a culture, we're missing out on a greater calling, which might be to address the reality of human suffering, its magnitude. What can we bring to that table? Can we move away from feeling like everything we do as Mormon people in the public sphere, as Mormon intellectuals, has to be about defending our own or focus so interior on our own tradition? Like John said, the historians, the clique, of Mormon historians, really. And this for me was epitomized in her book when she talks about, of course the Holocaust does nothing but yield unimaginable suffering, but amazing stories. But, the idea of the people kind of in the camps, putting God on trial and resolving that God was dead and then saying their prayers. When we can finally move past a place where we feel like we have to defend our tradition anytime we speak about it in public, then we'll be able to really explore its power in full.
But I like that discussion, but it feels like there's a hole in the bucket, Liza. It feels like the DNA argument against the Book of Mormon, the archaeological and historicity arguments against the Book of Mormon, even the Bible, it just feels like science has poked this big hole within Mormon belief, and thousands of people are draining out of the Mormon bucket every year. And from the people that I continue to talk to, apologists do a great job at helping people who aren't serious thinkers sort of say, well, smarter people have worked through all this, and I don't get that DNA argument, and I don't get all that papyrus stuff, but Hugh Nibley's smarter than me, and so I'm just going to sort of lean on these smart people and stay in the church, because I know that these, Daniel Peterson has already worked through it for me. There is a group of people for whom that's satisfactory. But for the people who are really smart or who take truth claims really seriously, they find apologetic defenses and arguments not only sorely wanting, but almost so discouraging and so unsatisfactory that apologetic answers actually accelerate both their disappointment and their disaffection from the church. And so I'm wondering, what if the church just shut everything down, told Farron Farms to go away, and what if they just said, we don't deal in the apologetics business. We don't defend who we are. We don't know everything, but our church is about, just like you said, Joanna, it's about hunger, and it's about social justice, although Glenn Beck might not approve. It's about loving our neighbor. It's about these rituals that we are engaged in. You know, could it be that apologetics is seriously damaging Mormonism, and that, you know, and is there a way for us to just shut that whole conversation down? Not say that, you know, you don't have to say that the DNA claims are illegitimate. You can say, hey, yeah, there are lots of reasons why you could question our doctrine and theology. That's not something we choose to do. We think that, you know, we're credible, but we're not going to spend our time there. We're going to spend our time elsewhere, and just shut down that, the hole in the bucket that it seems like apologetics almost feed. So, John, what's your response to that? And then Joanna.
Well, I think that the problem you would have with your, you know, shutting everything down, or, you know, saying we're not going to have farms and fair, and we're not going to answer these kind of questions when there's a challenge like DNA evidence or whatever it is. I mean, I think you would find this too, just in what your experience, John, is when people are coming to you with faith crises, they ask you specific questions, and if your answer is we do something else, we don't worry about that, we do charity work and all those kind of things, that wouldn't be a satisfactory answer, I think, for people who are struggling with, well, I've just decided, you know, what if this means that the Native Americans aren't, you know, Israelites, what, you know, or something like that, and they're coming to you with that question, and your answer is, well, we do charity work now. I don't think that would be satisfactory.
Okay, but what if it's this? What if it's not so dismissive, but you just say, look, we don't believe that science is conclusive in these areas, but we're not in the business. Like, what if they take a page from Karen Armstrong and say, we're not in the business of logos. We're not in the business of science. Science is going to cut its own way, and religion and spirituality works and operates under its own, rules and laws. And while we understand the claims, we've read them, we see their points, we feel like our religion still stands, and that's not a business we're going to get into. I think that can be a non-dismissive answer that doesn't provide a bad answer, like tapers, or what they, when they said horses,
right,
they
sure
meant tapers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that that, like you say, that the tapers thing is helping anybody.
Tapers.
Maybe it is. But, you know, I think that, yeah, what you have to do though is you can't replace something with nothing, you know, so you would have to come up with some other way that we're saying it. So that would be a major program shift all throughout all of like the church's materials, I think, where you would start saying, well, we aren't making these literalistic assertions, and so therefore we can't be challenged, you know, by science, because we're not saying that this scientifically happened or something like that. And so instead, we're always in all the manuals that's going to talk about the story of Abraham, not about Abraham the guy, you know, and all those kind of things, or the story of Amalekai or something like that, you know, so that it's always framed that way. You would have to go through and change everything in order to get off of the ground that right now the ground is there, and it has, you know, it more or less has to be defended as long as it's going to be stood on.
Joanna?
Yeah, I mean, you know, first of all, I have no stand on what the church should or shouldn't do, you know, I mean, and I don't know that I would want any segment of Mormon discourse to be, you know, shut down, especially if it is providing comfort and support to people who are seeking differently than I am. I just like to see a broader range of options for presenting ourselves to the world. I think there's room for us to be far less defensive. I think there's room for us to be a bit more fearless. So much of our energy is drained away by our apology. We barely, most, you know, dated, most, you know, I'm not talking about the general authorities here, but most common people really don't know how to talk about being Mormon to outsiders. We just don't. We don't know how to talk about ourselves well at all. But I think once you do learn to interact with people outside of our own community, you find that there are a lot of people on this planet who know what it means to inhabit a complicated tradition and love it, and still love it for all its complication. But in order to kind of enter that common conversation, we're going to have to acknowledge our commonality with other faith traditions. You know, that's hard. We, you know, especially as long as one holds to Orthodox belief that this is, you know, the true church. It's a matter of, will we be able to come to see ourselves as, you know, a peculiar and beloved people, but as one peculiar and beloved people among many peculiar and beloved peoples? I mean, that kind of pluralism is, you know, that I don't know. I don't, you know, that's a place I inhabit, but I make no recommendations on what the church should do, you know, but, there are a lot of people who understand what it means to inhabit a complicated tradition and still choose to love it.
Sure. And that's very hopeful. John, did you have anything to add to that?
No, I mean, I agree. So okay. Let me think about where I'm trying to play back where I was. Sorry, I got.
No, it's okay. Let me read a quote. I know that nobody's comfortable advising the church, but I mean, the truth is, the church is always having to look at where it is, where the world is, and how it's going to adjust. If you read Armand Moss's Angel in the Beehive, there's this constant, you know, leaning towards either retrenchment or assimilation. And, you know, some people see the church as intransigent, but I think if the church has shown anything, it's the capability to change, whether it's through shedding polygamy, at least as a practice, whether it's through shedding old Brighamite type doctrines, whether it's, you know, a lot of the emphases that we're now focusing. So I think it's worth at least discussing a little bit the implications for modernity in the church. And I wanted to start, and we'll kind of end on a couple of these questions and then with a few final thoughts, but there's a quote in Karen Armstrong's book, and I'll read it, and then I'll ask John Hamer for a response and Joanna for a response. Jay is tending to his sick child, and so we're going to excuse him for at least the time being, if not for the rest of the program. But Karen Armstrong writes, "Religious leaders often spend more time enforcing doctrinal conformity than devising spiritual exercises that will make these official beliefs a living reality in the daily lives of the faithful. Instead of using scripture to help people to move forward and embrace new attitudes, people quote ancient scriptural texts to prevent any such progress." Now, this is on page 325 in the epilogue of Karen Armstrong's book. So she's basically saying that we need to move away from enforcing doctrinal conformity and towards more spiritual exercises. And I would just ask the question, maybe I'm going to flip it and ask Joanna first. Could you make the argument that that is exactly what the church is doing? You could see how Bruce R. McConkie has been stripped from the Gospel Doctrines Manual. You can see how, you know, we're not sure about that God, you know, God-man couplet. That's just kind of a couplet. You know, I don't know that we teach it. I don't know that we practice it. The whole polygamy thing isn't doctrinal anymore. You know, as we said to Larry King.
Allegedly.
You could argue that this is exactly what we're doing, at least from the standpoint of no longer enforcing doctrinal and theological rigidity.
Oh, but see, I've experienced the last two decades differently. I think there's been a great deal of doctrinal enforcement. Now, some of that might be against, I'm still in the purge sometimes, and you know, September 6th and the feminist excommunications that followed in the years following. And I mean, I think we have retrenched and established, you know, at the same time, is there are movements towards, you know, adopting a fourth mission of the church. Marvelous. This is, you know, humanitarian, you know, purpose overtly as one of the great four missions of the church. But, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis on obedience for obedience's sake. There's also been proclamation on the family, which created new doctrine in some ways about the nature of gender, in ways that were overtly trying to choose the right word, overtly negative towards feminist theological impulses that really brought a lot of oxygen and energy into the tradition in the early 90s. So, you know, I see both going on. There is an expansiveness, but there is also a retrenchment right now, still going on.
Even in the past 5 years, Joanna?
Yeah. I live in the state of California.
So is that a Prop 8 reference?
Yeah, that was hard. I mean, that was obedience, and that was the proclamation on the family. And, you know, there are wonderful things about obedience, and there are wonderful things about the proclamation on the family, but I see those as being very conservative within Mormon tradition, very conservative movements in the Mormon tradition.
Very orthodox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. It's been hard.
Yeah, I have a lot of people tell me that Prop 8 led them out of the church. A lot of people. Hundreds and hundreds of people. John Hamer, what's your thoughts on whether the church is becoming less theological, less doctrinal, less orthodox, and whether it should?
I guess that you've cited the most recent changes. There has been a long trend. I think the transition moment for the church was when, the turn of the early 20th century. It was this moment of deciding whether or not it wanted to continue to be completely outside of the American norm and be doing, Mormon things that the rest of the country was absolutely opposed to and was trying to do everything to stop. And then that's the pivot when you get into the second and third generation of actual members who aren't all converts, but they're actually raised in a church, and the church just switches massively from being completely out of the mainstream to trying to be hyper-conforming to the American mainstream as much as possible. And so there's been a continual path ever since then to delete distinctives that are seen as being weird or make people uncomfortable. So and so I think that those changes that you're citing, even things as much like the deleting the practice of not ordaining black people, are all in that same path. In other words, that's just a continuance, and that I don't see a lot of actual change other than just where that path is fixed and going forward.
What about innovations in spirituality in the lives of the membership? Trying to augment the spiritual experience that the average Mormon has.
So I think that one thing that has definitely happened since I was, a kid in the church, what I've observed in going back and visiting people now is that this, the temple, the program of building all of these temples actually has had a big change. So there is now, it's much more temple-based Mormonism than ever existed. Well, I was a mission field Mormon as a kid. Mm-hmm. We didn't have temples. There was no, and now there's so much emphasis on temple attendance and even temple theology, all kinds of things like that. So I do think that is something that has changed as a result of, building all the temples.
And that is really exciting because, among contemporary religions, we are one of the very few with such a highly demarcated ritual sphere. Does that make sense? That's not happening in mainline Protestantism. That's not happening in, we are fairly unique, not totally, but fairly unique in that. And I think that's exactly the kind of ritual discipline practice that Armstrong wants to celebrate. My question is, does it always lead to the kind of liberal compassion output that she imagines? I'm not sure that it does, but I do think we're doing the mythos in Mormonism, and it is that kind of discipline and that kind of ritual practice is very special.
Well, let's draw this wonderful discussion to a close. So let me go ahead and read this wonderful story out of The Case for God on page 278. One day a group of Jews decided to put God on trial. In the face of such inconceivable suffering, they found the conventional arguments utterly unconvincing. If God was omnipotent, he could have prevented the Shoah. If he could not stop it, he was impotent. And if he could have stopped it, but chose not to, he was a monster. They condemned God to death. The presiding rabbi pronounced the verdict. Then they went on calmly to announce that it was time for the evening prayer. Ideas about God come and go, but prayer, the struggle to find meaning, even in the darkest circumstances, must continue. And this seems to point to what I think is one of Karen Armstrong's, you know, most emphatic points. And also, I think it's a wonderful way to maybe conclude this discussion with your guys' thoughts. And it's going to be interesting to get perspectives from both of you. But basically, it seems like what Karen Armstrong is saying is the only viable natural theology, as she describes it, lies in what she calls religious experience. She's very big on the doing. And it's very ironic because when Terry Gross asked her whether she engages in any religious tradition or in any rituals, she admits very readily not only that is she bad at prayer and doesn't really pray in the traditional sense, but she doesn't really attend any particular denomination, and she considers her academic scholarly work, which I would argue to be logos, as her main religious practice. But even so, I think there's something beautiful in that once we stop trying to separate the logos from the mythos. But first I'm going to ask John Hamer, who's someone who actually has left the traditional LDS church, but I would venture to say is definitely not a non-religious person, or to eliminate the double negatives. I think, John Hamer, you are a religious person, and you might even feel comfortable describing yourself in some ways as a spiritual person. So what do you think about her culminating argument that religion is all about the practice? And then we'll turn it over to Joanna with some final comments in the same light.
Well, I think in this conversation I might have come off as being very skeptical and skeptical about what she's doing. And it's not, though, that I'm not open to it. I'm actually very interested in it because, in a lot of ways, this program that she's doing, which is where she is trying to construct, her own kind of theology, and she's trying to construct her own belief and religion and her own practice and universalizing it and looking for precedents for it and all these kind of things. That is, in a lot of ways, the process that I've been going through for the past 3 years, where I've just been doing all kinds of study, both of scripture, of scriptural criticism, but also of the history of theology, all of the history of religious philosophy and that kind of thing, and trying to decide in a way on a personal theology and a personal practice and all those kind of things for me. But for me also, though, with what she brings out as interesting as it is, and as much as I'd like to, you know, I'd like to get closer to it and think about it more and be open to it. When you guys were bringing that analogy up about the symphony and then the guy lecturing about the symphony, I'm the person over there in that lecture hall. I want to listen to the lecture rather than the symphony. And so it's kind of it's a problem for me. I don't meditate. I'm no good at what she's talking about in terms of banishing, you know, thought from your head and just experiencing things. And I just simply can't do anything like that. And so anyway, I'm interested in it. I'm not dismissing it as a thing that is potentially important. It's just a matter of, can that kind of thing, can I relate to it, or do I just accept that other people who are in the community that I'm in, you know, might find that useful? So.
Yeah, and that's good, John, because I know there are a lot of people who just don't speak the spiritual language in the way that it's traditionally communicated. And there has to be a place for them. And that's probably why it's so important that we don't eliminate the logos and other non-traditional forms. But Joanna, why don't you take a shot at expressing what you love about this final culminating assertion by Karen Armstrong?
Oh, I feel like so much great and weighty and sweet content has already been laid out in this podcast. I'm I don't know, I just, coming back to the image of the camps and, that you used to introduce this question, John. And, you know, the idea that what is left after a great disappointment is prayer. I mean, practice, that practice has been, the orienting practice for me through a lot of different faith stages and transitions. And I love her emphasis on it here. This book resonated with me a great deal, even though I could see, you know, flaws in its methodology and how it was carefully constructed in a certain way as an argument. And, you know, and yet I find myself very much, a participant in the moment she's describing, you know, very comfortable with not holding on to doctrinal particulars, but with trying to maintain a discipline and a practice. And part of that practice is prayer. And part of that practice also, though, is figuring out how to maintain a relationship to a tradition that is, for me, complicated, but that is still my home. You know, and bringing a good heart and a good mind, that to this matter, that takes an awful lot of discipline, as you know. I mean, as anyone who's, you know, come through some transition in their Mormonism knows, it takes work and discipline to keep bringing an openness of heart and seeking for the good, you know, back and back and back again. So, you know, that describes my practice. You know, the ongoing search to find out how to maintain, you know, a good relationship to God through the tradition I was raised in. So this book works for me.
So to sum up, we're all converts to apophatic theology.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. Although I still like God the Mother. I don't want to lose that image. It's so subjective.
No, I was teasing. I just wanted to say the word apathetic again.
Oh, I get you.
Well, this has been fascinating. What I loved about her book, just to conclude, just one quick thought. In her very opening introduction, she makes the point that God is hard, that religion is hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
And, you know, I think there's a lot of profundity in that. That there is a stage three Fowler like level where everything's answered. The answers are simple. Obedience is clear, and everything can be wrapped up and packaged in a tight, neat little bow, and the world is wonderful. And then it all falls apart. But then there can be a beauty in the struggle and in the wrestling and in the search to try and make meaning from the transcendence that we often still feel, even as atheists sometimes, we still feel. And to try and pull together the remnants of the community and the theology and the doctrine and the faith and the prayer that we all still sometimes feel pulled towards, if we can lose this notion that everything's simple and re-engage religion as if it's difficult, but in the same way that lifting weights is difficult, it can also make us stronger. Maybe many of us can rediscover an appreciation for the struggle that is religion and spirituality. And that's the thought that I wanted to conclude with in this book. So
that was so pretty. I want to embroider it on a sampler. That was lovely.
On a doily?
No, not a doily. Like on a little frame on the wall. Like, you know, no success in the world compensates for failure in the home. Instead of that, I want what you just said.
Okay. Well, good luck. Good luck distilling it. My ramblings. John Hamer and Joanna Brooks and J. Nelson Seawright, I want to thank you all for coming on this podcast. You guys have been wonderfully fabulous.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
And for our listeners, I want to encourage you all to please come up to the blog, MormonStories.org, and leave us your comments and thoughts. And I want to extend an open invitation to anyone who cares enough about the past couple hours and has their own insight. What I'll do is I'll pick a day next week where I'm just on Skype, and I'll be happy to invite panelists back if they want to come on or bring on other panelists who listened and want to comment. But we would love to take your calls and engage in a discussion about your thoughts and reactions to what we talked about today. So without any further ado, thank you for joining us at MormonStories.org. Please email us at MormonStories@gmail.com. Come up to our website, And thank you so much for tuning in, and take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you. Still